This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's finally a date for a Middle East peace conference. Secretary of State James Baker announced earlier today that the conference will open October 30th in Madrid. The human rights group Middle East Watch wants the United States to use its new influence in the Middle East to improve human rights there. Middle East Watch has just released a new edition of its report on the Assad regime's suppression of human rights in Syria. My guest is Andrew Whitley, Executive Director of Middle East Watch. Andrew Whitley, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now that there is actually a date for these peace talks, I'm wondering what your hopes are for these talks, if you think that they will be productive.
I'd like to think that they were productive. Certainly from our particular perspective, we don't think that human rights considerations are going to be a major element in those negotiations. There are, of course, those in the Arab world and perhaps in the United States also who think that the issue of self-determination for the Palestinians is a basic human right in itself. That doesn't happen to fall within our particular mandate, though I respect the opinions of those who feel that this should be the case. I think that as far as the talks themselves are concerned, people go into them without very high expectations that they're going to produce large breakthroughs. The auguries are not particularly good. But I would like to feel that at least there will be some progress made directly between Israel and the Palestinians, possibly on some form of limited autonomy, to be able to break the impasse, which has really been a very discouraging feature of the region for the last few years.
How do you interpret Syria's refusal to attend the regional phase of the talks? That's the phase in which they'll discuss issues like water rights, arms control, and economic problems. And also the Syrian foreign minister's statement earlier this week that he wouldn't shake the hand of Israel's foreign minister.
Well, Syria likes to continue to burnish its so-called radical credentials, even though those have been in practice jettisoned in the last year or two, as Assad has moved very pragmatically, much closer to the West and to the conservative Arab states. So I think they're playing to the gallery there, to the gallery in the Arab world, which accuses it of having sold out and being interested in a separate deal with Israel. I think as far as the broader regional talks are concerned, that Syria would be prepared to go along with those, but obviously it wants to be able to keep it as a concession. It'll make it a later stage in the negotiations, depending on how the first stage goes.
Why are you choosing this as a time to call attention to human rights violations in Syria?
We actually brought out our report some time ago. We have introduced this new report now as a guide to readers on the Assad regime because we think that it hasn't had the attention that it's deserved. And we think that as the United States has obviously decided that in the wake of the Gulf War that Syria is a truly crucial ally, that it's important to be able to expose the nature of this country, which has been given considerable amount of leeway to be able to get away with quite gross violations of human rights.
Is Assad any worse than other Middle East dictators in terms of human rights?
In some ways he is, yes. We always find ourselves slightly uncomfortable with doing a league table of dictators. But I think that in terms of his approach, while he is not somebody who personally bloodies his hands, he's not a brutal thug. He is somebody, though, who has permitted quite extraordinary actions against his opponents. There are people in his jails who have been there for more than 20 years now, without charges, without trial, who were personal opponents of his. At one stage, people who had been political colleagues or army colleagues who fell out with him, he refuses even to bring those people to trial. Some of those who have been tried, people who were abducted in Lebanon, brought back to Syria, are now still in jail 6 years after their jail terms had expired. I think the record is one in terms of the numbers of people who are held without trial, the way in which the regime is prepared to crack down when there's any threat to Assad's personal position, however mild that criticism might be, suggests that limits of tolerance are very narrow indeed. It's not the worst of regimes in the sense that there are some areas where it is possible for personal cultural expression or for individuals to be able to continue a reasonably normal life, provided that they stay out of politics or that they don't attempt to organize themselves or indeed to set up a publication which might not have the total imprimatur of the Syrian censorship and security authorities. But if people keep their noses clean and stay out of politics, then it's possible to have a reasonable life.
Assad took power in a bloodless coup in 1970 and declared a state of emergency. Is that state of emergency still in effect?
Yes, it is. That state of emergency permits the government to be able to hold prisoners without trial, to be able to set up summary courts which are devoid of any form of protection in terms of their procedures. And it is indeed one of the worst features of the regime, because it gives the government such blanket powers to be able to take action against any perceived dissident.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Whitley, Executive Director of the human rights group Middle East Watch, and they've just issued a report, an updated report, on human rights violations in Syria. The report cites around 10,000 Syrian citizens killed during the 1980s and thousands more jailed. For what kinds of activities are Syrians routinely killed or imprisoned?
The incidents you referred to took place in a series of bloody encounters between the Syrian government and the Muslim Brotherhood, which at that time was a particularly powerful force which the regime saw as its most serious opponents. And those mass killings have largely disappeared. There is not the organized opposition in the country any longer. People are picked up these days because of their opposition, for example, to the war in the Gulf. There were some 70 or 80 intellectuals, lawyers, writers, professors, who signed a memorandum of protest to President Assad during the Gulf War, protesting against Syria's decision to send troops together with the Allies to the war front. Now, they were treated by Syrian standards relatively mildly. They were interrogated, held briefly, and most of them released. A few of them, including a Bahraini dissident, somebody who had been in exile in Damascus, continued to remain in jail. The other people who continue to be picked up are members of small left-wing parties, usually, or else people from Lebanon. That's an area that has been grossly underreported and perhaps ignored by most people, because we're unaware most of the time of what the Syrian security forces are doing in the areas of Lebanon that they control. So you find a rather mixed picture, one in which people continue to be detained for presenting a threat to the actions of the Syrian security forces in Lebanon, for example, or who might be perceived as being critics of the Syrian suzerainty over that country. On the other hand, in the last year or so, there have been a number of releases. I think relatively small numbers. We have evidence of about 170 people who were released. That's 170 political prisoners in the country, apart from a larger group of Palestinians who were released, maybe 1,500, possibly 2,000 Palestinians who were released. But we have to keep these numbers in context. The Palestinians claim that there are probably 4,000 to 5,000 Palestinians still being held in jails in Syria without charges again. And there are anywhere up to, according to the Syrian human rights organizations, up to 13,000 to 15,000 political prisoners still in that country. So they're small concessions which are being made, and perhaps too much shouldn't be made of them.
Assad is the head of state, the head of the army, and the head of the legal system, which gives him basically unlimited power,
yes, in
Syria. Now, he's been compared to Saddam Hussein in the sense that lots of people have been warning that Assad might be the next Saddam, in the sense that we are now allies with Syria, as we were allies with Saddam during the Iran-Iraq war, and this might get us into trouble like it did after the Iran-Iraq war. But it seems that Assad's personal style is very different than Saddam Hussein's. I mean, even just looking at him, he doesn't look like a central casting dictator in the way that Saddam does. Can you kind of compare their dictatorial styles?
Yes, I could. And you're right to be able to point out the superficial similarities between the two regimes and the context of the United States possibly repeating the mistake that it did with Iraq in the past. The style difference is one that's partly reflected by the nature of the ruler. Assad is a much more cerebral person than Saddam Hussein is. He isn't given for the hysterical or demagogical appearances that Saddam Hussein has had in the past. And he is somebody who really operates from behind the scenes, pulling the strings through his variety of different security services. Perhaps one of the most striking differences is that in Iraq, where there is one overall security service and two or three smaller ones that are personal security forces for the ruler himself, in Syria, there are anywhere up to 12 or possibly 15 different security services operating in various different areas, sometimes overlapping functions, sometimes in competition with each other. Assad, as a member of a minority himself, he's from the Alawi sect, is very careful not to put all his eggs in one particular basket, and he's constantly playing one group off against another, trying to bring in people to seduce them into government or to be able to buy them off. And the style is one in which people have been permitted to participate to a greater extent in government, but the difference, or rather the bottom line remains that there is really no successor to Saddam Hussein, to President Assad in sight, as there is for Saddam Hussein. It remains a system in which one man's life and one man's whims continue to control the destinies of their people.
Does Assad have the kind of personality cult around him that Saddam Hussein does? You know, posters all over, statues of his likeness.
To not the same extent, but he does to a degree. There is a degree of hero worship, and certainly in his rare appearances in public or on television these days, there is very much an attempt to build up the personality cult by his handlers in the presidential palace. But he is somebody who is a more aloof, rather shyer person. His health has not been so good in recent years. And I think it doesn't go down quite so well with the sort of mass rallies that Saddam Hussein had gone in for.
Is there any room for dissidence within Syria? Is there any part of a free press? Can you write novels that are questioning of the government?
These are good questions. The fact that a human rights organization which has publicly announced itself in Paris and claims to have cells in other parts of Syria can exist and is known to exist by the Syrian authorities, and that their members continue in however clandestine a fashion to be able to get information out, shows that the repression has eased somewhat in the last 18 months or so. And I think in part that has to be seen as being a reflection of the relationship with the United States, and also the sense by Assad that he has to let his people breathe a little bit more freely. It is possible to be able to create quite a lively cultural existence in the country, to write novels, as you say, make films. People come from other parts of the Arab world, particularly from the more conservative, in social terms, Arab states of the peninsula, to be able to come to Damascus to participate in its cultural life. One can drink there. Relations between the sexes are much easier there. It's possible to participate in a reasonably lively intellectual life, to watch films that you wouldn't be able to watch elsewhere in the Arab world or in some parts of the conservative regions of the Arab world. So to a degree, there is a certain amount of cultural freedom, but where it comes down to printed expression, the mass media remains very tightly under government control, and it really is not possible to set up any newspaper without total censorship by the government, or to be able to express any point of view that might be dissident from that of the government. In fact, in the past, people who have been speechwriters for Saddam Hussein or have been loyal spokesmen in the party newspapers, if they had not caught up with the latest zigzag of policy that President Assad had done, would find themselves expressing an outdated opinion and themselves would be out of a job or worse, sometimes jailed. So it remains a country where you have to watch your back very much if you're concerned about speaking of anything that might smack of politics.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Whitley. He's the executive director of the human rights group Middle East Watch. The group has just published a new edition of its report on human rights abuses in Syria. It's called Syria Unmasked. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Andrew Whitley is my guest, executive director of the human rights group Middle East Watch. I want to get back to the comparison between Assad and Saddam Hussein. We've seen that Saddam Hussein has great ambitions in the Middle East. What about Assad? Do you think that he is as internationally aggressive as Saddam Hussein has proven to be?
He has more limited and more realistic ambitions. Syria does see itself as being one of the ancient centers of power in the Middle East, and as a country that, despite its relatively small population of 12 million and its limited economic resources, has a traditional role to play as a major power in that part of the world. Certainly, its relationships towards its neighbors, Lebanon and to Jordan, have always been of big brother to little brother. The recent treaty between Syria and Lebanon effectively gives Syria the unity that it has long sought with Lebanon and gives it the dominant voice to be able to control that country. So his goals are much more practical. They're really to realize in a genuine sense the greater Syria that has been the dream of many Syrian leaders for the past generation, to be able to establish its authority as the prominent power in that part of the world. I think that he does not have the elements of megalomania that President Saddam Hussein had when he had attempted to build a nuclear weapons program that would have effectively blackmailed the entire region into following Iraq's dictates.
You would like to see the United States pressure Syria to improve the quality of life, to improve human rights in that country. What do you think the United States really wants from Syria now, and what do you think Syria really wants from the United States?
What the United States is looking for from Syria is a constructive attitude towards regional alignments. The fact that Syria took part in the Gulf War was a very important step indeed. The fact that it is now going along with the peace plans is also very important, to be able to wean it away from its previous position as the leading rejectionist power, the pole around which the other rejectionist countries would anchor themselves in order to oppose any U.S. attempt to be able to bring about a lasting peace between Israel and its neighbors and secure recognition for Israel. If the United States can pull this off, I think that it's managed a considerable coup in terms of the disposition of regional powers and establishing the basis for a longer peace in the region. What the U.S. then does with that influence is very much an open question, and we don't see much signs that it's prepared to use its influence, which is quite enormous, on both diplomatic levels at the international level and in economic terms, or potentially in the future military supply terms. It doesn't exist at the moment. But we would like to see the United States pressing President Assad to lift the state of emergency, to be able to pull his troops out of Lebanon, and to limit that agreement with the Lebanese to much more apolitical areas rather than the more political ones which are presently predominate in the agreement.
What do you think Syria wants from the United States?
I think what Syria is looking for is, first of all, international legitimacy, recognition of its position in the region as being an important power, to move out from the isolation and near pariah status that it's been in for some years, particularly since the withdrawal of the Soviet Union and its effective abandonment of its former allies such as Syria in the region. And it's secondly going to be looking for economic assistance through the World Bank and the IMF to be able to see that the restoration of diplomatic relations and the full flowering of cooperation should eventually have some economic benefits. The Syrian economy remains in very bad state indeed. And as a final point, I think that what Syria is looking for would be to put pressure on Israel to be able to make some territorial concessions over the Golan Heights. That remains a very important point. And that, plus the future of Israeli troops in southern Lebanon, is something that Syria obviously would like to be able to use the U.S. Intermediary role with Israel on.
What kind of condition did the collapse of the Soviet Union, which used to be Syria's backer, what kind of condition did that collapse leave Syria in?
It removed an area of economic assistance that the Syrians had relied on for some time, but that had been gradually weaned. What it meant was that Syria had to cast around for assistance from other countries, particularly from Saudi Arabia and from the Iranians, who provided oil on the concessionary terms. And it also left the Syrians with a very large military debt to the Soviet Union, which I think in all realistic terms, the Soviet Union can't be expecting to get repaid. But nonetheless, it left them with the position in which they had to start paying hard cash for their military supplies.
I want to get back to the Middle East peace talks. What do you see as being the greatest obstacles that will have to be overcome at those talks in order for anything to come of them?
I think the greatest obstacles are really going to be the nature of the concessions that Israel is prepared to make. After all, the two sides are, on the face of it, diametrically opposed, one side insisting that there be a land for peace element in the negotiations, and the Israelis insisting that there is no territorial component, as they describe it, to these negotiations. What they're prepared to offer is very simply a state of peace to formally ratify the de facto ceasefires that have been in existence for many decades. So in order to be able to overcome that particular hurdle, there's going to have to be some very delicate work done by the United States and others to try to persuade some halfway house to be able to be found for the Syrians, for the Palestinians, for example, to be able to demonstrate that they're coming out of these talks with something to show. Otherwise, the backlash in the occupied territories is going to be very severe indeed. I think that the possibilities of terrorism and of a violent upsurge against the participants in the conference is a very real one.
If you were Israeli, would you trust Syria if Syria made some concessions?
I don't think you're in a position to be able to argue whether we should trust it or not trust it. Israel's ultimate trust is its own military forces and the quality of its intelligence, and that is not altered in one way or another by making those concessions. It's true that the sensitive installations that are on the Golan Heights and on Mount Hermon are particularly important to Israel, and I think some sort of compromise will have to be worked out whereby, for example, that Israel were to cede formal sovereignty over much of the Golan Heights to Syria, but were to retain a practical presence in the region to be able to continue its monitoring of Syrian military communications from those installations. Something like that is not beyond the bounds of possibility, and I think Assad might be prepared to sacrifice the reality for the symbol, at least in the short term.
Well, Andrew Whitley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Whitley is the executive director of the human rights group Middle East Watch, and that group's new report, Syria Unmasked, The Suppression of Human Rights by the Assad Regime, has just been published by Yale University Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.